Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, and welcome to this Friday edition of Catholic Answers Live. This hour, we discuss the natural law, and one of the world's leading thinkers on the topic is here to help us do that. He'll help us think through just what we mean by the natural law, maybe how to understand how the natural law can bring clarity to individuals and societies as they make their choices. And if you have questions about the natural law, if you'd like to know how natural law can be used to clarify moral questions, maybe you'd like to know how to apply natural law thinking in the world today, please give us a call, 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour is Dr. J. Bujaszewski, Dr. B, as I'll be calling him. He blogs at undergroundthomist.org. He's the author of numerous books, including most recently On the Meaning of Sex, Commentary on Thomas Aquinas's Treatise on Law, and just this month, Commentary on Thomas Aquinas's Virtue Ethics. Dr. Bujaszewski, thank you so much for being with us today at Catholic Answers Live.
I'm glad to be with you.
And virtue ethics is, I note that's often in maybe a secular setting, it's taught as, there are these different ways of approaching ethics, you know, maybe like a utilitarian and another. And virtue ethics will be put in there. What do we mean by virtue ethics, and should it be kind of grouped with all these other ethical systems?
Well, you're right that it's often thought of in a sort of a strange way that Thomas Aquinas wouldn't have accepted and that I don't accept, as though it's just one more alternative among other ways of thinking about ethics like utilitarianism. That's really very silly. Let's think of it this way. Whenever we are thinking of how we should live, whenever we are thinking of how we were made to live, of how we need to live, of what's right and what's wrong and what's good and what's evil, there are two things that we need to think about. We need to think about the rules, and we need to think about the virtues. They're not alternatives to each other. They complement each other. We have to think about the principles of how to live, but we also have to have built into our character by discipline the, let's say, the habits of the heart that enable us to actually live that way. And those are the virtues.
And so how does this idea that the virtues, we need to build up these habits in order to actually live in a virtuous way, how does that connect with the idea of natural law?
Well, it's let's think of it this way. By the natural law, we mean the moral law, the same moral law that's expressed in the Ten Commandments. And the reason that we call it the natural law is to call attention to the fact that our human nature was made to live by it and made to know it. When I say we were made to live by it, I mean, for example, that families don't thrive unless the spouses are faithful to each other and the children honor their parents, and those are principles of natural law. When I say we were made to know it, I mean that it's no mystery to us. St. Paul even said that it's written on the heart. That means it's built into the deep structure of the moral mind, of the moral intellect. In fact, there are even certain things about right and wrong that are so deeply impressed on our intellect that we can't not know them. It's impossible not to know, for instance, that it's wrong to deliberately take innocent human life. Now, that's why the natural law is called natural, but some of the virtues can be called natural in this sense. They are... I need to distinguish between two different senses of the word natural. Sometimes when we say natural, we mean something that people always do. Well, the virtues are not natural that way. But sometimes when we say that something is natural, we mean that a being of a certain nature, like ourselves with our human nature, can't thrive, can't live well unless it has this. And that's the sense in which the virtues are natural. You may not have them, okay, but they are things that we need to have, that beings of our nature, of the humankind, have to have in order to live well, in order to flourish in the way that a human being should flourish. And they and they partner with the laws.
So it strikes me that when you describe the natural law in that way, it's almost diametrically, maybe it is in fact diametrically opposed to moral relativism. It's the moral,
absolutely.
So the moral relativist will say, well, there's different moralities for different times and places. And so the person who embraces the natural law says, no, that's not true, that everybody everywhere knows that murder is wrong. They may suppress that knowledge or something, but they know it. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Now, I don't deny that some matters of very fine detail may vary. For instance, just as expressing gratitude is a natural law. It's you can't imagine any circumstance in which it would be wrong to have gratitude when people have done good to you. There's no culture, in fact, in which the virtue of gratitude isn't recognized and the duty of gratitude isn't recognized. That's universal. On the other hand, there could be some small variations. The way in which you express gratitude may be different in one culture than in another, and that's okay. We ought to have regard for the safety of our neighbors while we're driving on the road, and that's a universal. But whether you drive on the left or on the right side of the road, that may vary from place to place. Because of these variations in application, some people have become confused, and they think that there are variations at the level of fundamental principle. And that's just not true. There are no variations at the level of fundamental principle. Somebody may not follow the fundamental principle. He may pretend to himself that he doesn't know it, but they really are universals.
And so if these things are universal, taken from a Christian perspective, if you say there's such a thing as a natural law, that is, we have a nature and we need to live consistently with that, why do we need God or Christ or the scriptures? Do you see what I'm saying? If we already know what's right and wrong, why do we need those other things?
Well, there are several problems here. Number one, I think we all really do know deep down the moral basics, but it doesn't follow that we know all of the moral details. For instance, I may know that it's wrong to steal, but I may be very confused about whether I would be guilty of theft if somebody said, would you hold on to my car keys for me when we went into a restaurant? And then he disappeared for a while and he came back to the table drunk and he said, I'm ready for my car keys now. And I thought, would it be stealing? He's drunk. He can't drive. Would it be stealing for me to withhold them from him? A person could be confused about that. So divine law, revelation sometimes helps us to understand some things better. Divine law is also important because it confronts us, because very often we may know what's right, but we pretend to ourselves that we don't know it. And when God just puts it down in black and white and says, honor your parents, be faithful to your spouse, it's very hard for us to go on pretending that we don't know. And the most important reason, I think, is that even though we may know the moral basics, we just have a difficult time living up to them. That's because of sin. We are, yes, these are natural, but the fact is that ever since the fall, we've been out of joint with our own nature. We are plagued with desires that go against our own deepest good. And so we need the grace of God, which heals our nature and also lifts us up above our nature to supernatural love or charity, so that we can live in the way that God intended.
888-318-7884 is the number. Dr. Jay Bujaszewski is our guest this hour, and we are talking natural law. If you have questions about the natural law, give us a call at that number, 888-318-7884. And, Doctor, well, I'm going to say Dr. B now, if that's all
right
with you.
And it certainly is. It's pretty tiresome to say Bujaszewski over and over and over.
It's not tiresome. It's just I'm afraid I'm not going to get it right. Like, I don't want to, if I've got a good record so far, I don't want to mess that up. So we live in what we call a pluralistic society. It's an increasingly a society of nuns, you know, people who say they have no particular religious affiliation. How can... Or maybe it can't. I don't know. Can natural law arguments and natural law thinking have a place in that kind of a society?
Oh, sure. You know, many people, when they hear about natural law, they object because they say, oh, that's just a religious thing. It is true that the deepest intellectual heavy lifting in the theory of natural law has been done by religious believers, and especially by Christians, and especially by Catholics. But that's different than saying that the natural law is Catholic morality. What the natural law is human morality. It's just something that Catholics talk about. Take the Ten Commandments. Sure, they're in the Bible, and sure, the Bible is a religious book. But can you find a culture, a society, anywhere in the world that isn't dimly aware, at least, of the fact that you ought to be faithful to your spouse, you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't murder? You know, all of these things are really recognized everywhere. If they weren't, we couldn't call this the natural law. We'd have to call it the Catholic law or the Christian law or something like that. But the fact is, it was made for human nature, and we do share that human nature. It is common ground. Now, I don't want to deny to you that it is that because of the fall, because of our desires to evade our duties, because we want to make excuses when we do wrong, it's slippery common ground. It's hard to stand on,
yeah.
But it does exist, and that can be done. There are a lot of practical difficulties, which we can talk about, in making a natural law argument, but it can be done just because, well, for the same reason that you can make a scientific argument. It isn't as though the moon is made of stone for me, but it's made of cheese for you.
Right.
What it's made of is a matter of the nature of the moon, which we can work out by the use of our intellectual powers and our observation. In the same way, whether it's right or wrong to murder is not right. Well, it isn't right for you and wrong for me, or vice versa. It's the same for all of us, and we can work that out too by the exercise of our rational powers. In fact, we don't have to exercise them very hard because that one's pretty obvious.
So moral thinking then is not a matter of invention, it's a matter of discovery.
That's precisely correct. It's a matter of discovery. And even when people say, well, how can we be sure that there's a natural law? You know, just engage that person in a conversation about something right and wrong. Say, you know, is there any moral law that you think that we ought to follow? And he might say something obvious like, well, I shouldn't hurt people on purpose. I'll say, well, all right, that's the natural law. It's true for all people, and all people are able to know it. That's what we mean when we say that it's natural, that it's true for all people, and all people are able to know it.
We are talking natural law with Dr. Jay Budziszewski today on Catholic Answers Live. Your calls are more than welcome if you have questions on the natural law. 888-318-7884 is the number. I am your host, Cy Kellett, and we will be back right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn. That one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into, or back to, the practice of the Catholic faith. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In John 6, when Jesus had crossed the Sea of Galilee, A large crowd followed him because they saw the signs he was performing. When he noticed the size of the crowd, he took 5 barley loaves and 2 fish and miraculously fed them all with food left over. It has been suggested that the people actually had more food than was previously apparent, and that the real miracle lay in the fact that they actually shared what they had with each other. There is absolutely no evidence of this in the gospel. This stance actually suggests that there is more value in a purely human explanation than in having faith in the Lord's ability to work a miracle. But over and over, Jesus said to those he had healed, "It is your faith that has saved you." Nowhere do we find him saying, "It is your natural explanation that has saved you." Nor will such lack of faith ever save us. Our only hope lies in our faith in him. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
We're talking natural law this hour on Catholic Answers Live. Dr. Jay Bujaszewski is our guest. You're welcome. He has already approved it. You are welcome to call him Dr. B if that is more comfortable for you. And we'll go to calls. Dr. B?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Alex in San Antonio, Texas, listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite Radio. You are on with Dr. B. What's your question?
Hi there. So my question is, with respect to natural law, how do we distinguish between like venial and grave sins, like serious sins and not serious sins, if that's possible?
Okay. Well, now some of the questions that you're asking, like the distinction between venial sin and mortal sin, is not really a natural law question. It's a question that natural law by itself, without the help of revelation, without the extra data of revelation, can't answer. Here's why. What the difference between mortal sin and venial sin has to do with the fact that although all sin weakens charity, mortal sin uproots charity. It destroys it at the root. Now, charity, though, divine charity, is not one of the ordinary natural virtues. It goes beyond them. It's not something we can whip up for ourselves. It has to be poured into us by the grace of God. It transforms the operation of the ordinary natural virtues like justice and temperance and courage and prudence and so forth. It gives them a different motive because you're acting for charity. And since that goes beyond, I mean, Christian natural lawyers can talk about both charity and the ordinary natural virtues because they're not working just with natural law, but with Christian revelation too. But if they did stick to just natural law, they wouldn't be able to say anything about it. So I can give an answer to you, but it has to do with what lies beyond our natural powers, what lies beyond the natural law, what comes to us by supernatural grace, which cooperates with human nature but lifts it to a higher level. Does that help?
Yeah, that helps. So in other words, we could, using natural law, we could kind of distinguish between sin and not sin, but just not serious sin and not serious sin.
I see. Well, let me put it this way. With natural law, you can distinguish between sin and not sin. And with natural law, you can distinguish among different degrees of sin. Yeah, sure. But one of the distinctions that we want to make when we're talking about the seriousness of sin, which you had mentioned, was between venial and mortal sin. That particular way of talking about the difference in seriousness goes beyond natural law. So sure, natural law theory can say... murdering somebody is worse than punching him in the nose, but it can't talk about the destruction of charity that would happen in you if you murdered somebody because charity is a supernatural virtue. It's a spiritual virtue. It's infused in us by God. It's beyond nature.
Okay.
So sure, it can say some things about more important and less important, but not that particular thing about less important and more important. Am I making sense? Does that help?
Yes, that helps. So, final thing would be, Would you be able to, like, give an example of a natural law argument distinguishing or, like, sort of showing the degree of, like, how you could logically show that one sin is worse than another?
Oh, sure. The question is, what are the goods that are involved in a moral duty, and how great is the destruction of the moral good that's involved in the particular sin that you're undertaking? If remember the example that I gave just a couple of seconds ago between hitting somebody in the nose and killing him, the destruction of life is a much greater harm to the human good than just the pain of a nose that's been bumped by a fist.
I let Alex go and I didn't even realize it. Thank you, Alex, for that call. I do indeed hope that was helpful. We go now to Bosnia in Oklahoma. Bosnia, you are on with Dr. Jay Bujashevsky. What's your question, please?
Hello. I was driving from work, so I turn on the radio and heard about natural law, moral law. So I just have one question. Is what is morally good commanded by God because in itself it's morally good, or is it morally good because it's commanded by God?
Yes, that's a very ancient question. It's sometimes called the Euthyphro dilemma because it takes its name from a conversation between the ancient pagan philosopher Socrates and his friend Euthyphro, and the question came up between them. In the classical natural law tradition, though, we would say that both of those answers are wrong. You notice that if you say God commands the natural law because he has to, if you say it's right because God commands it, then you're putting God above the moral law. If you say God commands it because it's right, you're putting the moral law above God. And what we actually believe is that God is identical to his own justice. That distinction is false in the first place. To put it another way, if you look into the nature of what is good all the way, you look as deep as you can, what you find is not a set of abstract principles. What you find is a person. What you find is the being of God himself. He is identical with his own goodness, and the moral law comes from that.
So, as we have in the Old Testament, when God commanded to kill, men, women, kids, everything, and if God were to command that to you, would you do it because God commanded it?
Well, let's take, for instance, the famous example of God commanding Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. I think that's often misunderstood. People say, oh my gosh, God is commanding Abraham to murder. And look, in the first place, God is the master of life and death. If you, without my permission, stole my automobile, took my automobile, that would be stealing. If I said to you, I would like you to take my automobile and go to the grocery store and pick up something, if you would be so kind as to do so, well, then it wouldn't be stealing. You'd be, because it's my auto that I'm giving you permission to take. God, so to speak, owns all of us. Now, there's a deeper issue here, though. God wasn't even commanding Abraham. God was, the way that this presents itself to us, we think, oh my gosh, it looks like God is commanding murder. But that's probably not how it looked to Abraham. This was very early. God hasn't taught people very much anymore. I mean, at that point. Abraham is living surrounded by pagan people who think nothing of child sacrifice. The gods, it seems, to those people just do things like commanding murder. So probably he's not scandalized by God's command because it's murder. He's scandalized by God's command because he's thinking, wait a minute, this God promised me that he was going to make I got to answer this one after the commercial.
Okay, let's do that then. Bosnia, thanks. If you'll hang on. More on the natural law on Catholic Answers Live when we come back. If you have questions on the natural law, 888-318-7884 is the number. We'll be right back to hear the continuation of that answer on about God's goodness and God's commands when we come back right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Bishop Jeffrey Monforton, Bishop of the Diocese of Steubenville. Make sure you keep it on Catholic Answers Live. God bless you.
We've all heard the phrase, the new evangelization. In previous centuries, missionaries would travel to foreign lands to evangelize, but today's missionaries are more likely to focus on fallen away Catholic neighbors or relatives. But what about the old evangelization? The two millennia of Catholic missionary efforts by the likes of St. Paul, St. Augustine of Canterbury, St. Francis Xavier, and most importantly, our Lord Himself. We must not forget the methods they used to spread the faith to the farthest reaches of the world. Our situation may be new, but the essentials of evangelization always remain the same. In his new book, The Old Evangelization, How to Spread the Faith Like Jesus Did, author Eric Sammons provides a practical guide to putting these essentials into practice in everyday use in your interactions with family, friends, coworkers, and even fellow parishioners. Order your copy of The Old Evangelization today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We as Catholics need to stand strong, to be prepared to mount a daily defense, to respond to the many challenges that we as believers are presented with every day. Jimmy Akin is here to help. His innovative new book, A Daily Defense, takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, 366 in all, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, with challenges and answers indexed alphabetically, so finding the answers can be quick and easy. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Next hour, the old evangelization. You've heard a lot about the new evangelization. We'll talk a little bit about the old evangelization with Eric Sammons, who has written a book entitled The Old Evangelization. This hour, we're talking natural law with Dr. Jay Bujaszewski, and he's probably one of the best people in the world you could have to talk to about the natural law. And when we left, Bosnia was asking a question about God commanding essentially murder or genocide or attacking innocents in the Hebrew Scriptures. And you were in the middle of your answer, Dr. B, so I'll let you continue.
Right. We were talking about the command of God to Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. And I'd made, first of all, the point that God is the just judge. He's the master of life and death. And it's not for him murder. I mean, after all, we're all going to die. But there is more to it than that. It certainly would seem disturbing if he just promulgated certain laws to us and then seemed indifferent to them himself. Thomas Aquinas says that God is identical to his own justice, and he actually cannot contradict his own justice. So that, how do we make sense of this business? I was explaining that for Abraham, the issue probably wasn't even killing. Abraham was surrounded by people who did practice things like infanticide, and probably what scandalized him wasn't that there had been a command to kill, but rather that if this command was carried out, he was going to lose his heir. And God had promised that a mighty nation would arise from him. So the question for Abraham then is trust. Do I believe this God? He promised me that he's going to raise a mighty nation from my descendants, and I've only got this one descendant in my old age, and now he says I'm to lose him. Can I trust this guy? That's the way the moral issue actually probably appeared to Abraham. Now, we know in the aftermath of the story, by the way, that it was not God's intention that Abraham actually kill his son. He was testing whether he trusted him, but he intervenes before Abraham can do the thing, and he sends the angel, and he says, stop. Okay, we know you trust God now, and we don't want you to do this. Moreover, as an earlier part of the story, Isaac himself, the son, says, we're going to sacrifice, we're going to make a sacrifice here. Where is the sacrifice? And he says, God himself will provide the sacrifice, my son. I think we tend to sometimes brush that off as though he's just making an excuse. But I think Abraham did believe it. I think he also trusted God that despite the fact that he could not understand this command, God was going to provide a way out. And God did provide a way out. He stops him. And then he did provide a sacrifice because there was the ram nearby with his horn with his horns tangled in a bush, and they sacrificed that. We learn later in the Old Testament that God actually abhors the sacrifice of children. He expresses his absolute execration of these practices among the pagan peoples surrounding them, and says, "You shall not pass your children through the fire." That was an expression that was used for infanticide because they literally rolled the infants down a little chute into a furnace in their fertility rites, and God is expressing his detestation of this. So, in fact, God was not actually God was not actually approving the murder of innocence. There are other things going on in here, and we're projecting our contemporary concerns into the story and misunderstanding what was actually happening in context.
Bosnia, thank you so much for that call. If you have a question about the natural law, 888-318-7884 is the number. We go now to Tom in Columbus, Ohio, listening on 820 AM St. Gabriel Radio. Tom, your question for Dr. Jay Bujaszewski.
Yes, greetings, Dr. Ty.
Greetings.
Can you hear me?
We can.
I can.
Is the question is, I want to make sure I can state this succinctly, ask this succinctly. Do we have the awareness of moral law because of our intellect?
Yes. Because of our intellect, mostly, the awareness of, let's put it this way, you know, in mathematics, we prove theorems, right? Now, what do we prove them with? We use deeper principles to prove them that are called axioms. Now, if you said, how do we prove the axioms? A mathematician is going to say, that's the wrong question to ask. You don't have to prove the axioms. You just know them. They are what you use to prove everything else by. Now, it's the same thing with the first principles of right and wrong, the deepest principles of right and wrong, the moral basics, you might say, function like axioms. Very complex moral conclusions may be proven from more basic considerations, but the moral basics aren't proven. They are simply evident to the mind. They are known in themselves. Now, that's the basics of the answer, but I do want to add one thing. You said, do we know this by intellect? There are some other things that come to the assistance of our intellects. Our feelings, for instance, come to the assistance of our intellects. And this is one of the reasons why when our feelings are disordered, it is more difficult for us to think clearly and to recognize the truth with our minds than it would be otherwise. And, you know, we talked about the virtues at the beginning of the program. One of the things that the virtues involve is learning to not only think clearly, but also to feel what we should feel about the right things and in the right way. So that helps. Our feelings cooperate with our minds in the process of moral reasoning.
Tom, does that address your concern?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Oh, very, very good. Thank you, Tom, for that call. We appreciate it. And we are talking natural law on Catholic Answers Live with Dr. Jay Bujaszewski, but you are welcome to call him Dr. B. We go now to Monica in Southern California, listening on the mighty 930 AM. Monica, you are on with Dr. B. What's your question?
Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon.
Question. Thank you. In the Bible, one of the commandments states, honor thy father and thy mother. That's something that my husband and I are very big with our kids currently. But I'm going to take a step back. I come from a family. There's five of us siblings. And my father and my mother divorced when the oldest was only 7 and the youngest 2 were only 12 months old. My father abandoned us completely, never came back, never contacted us, and we suffered greatly in poverty and many other things that most families could have had. And my mother struggled, but she kept us all together. Father came back a few years later when I was already an adult. But where I'm getting at is now he wants us to take care of him, look after him. But for the 5 of us, there's that love does not exist within us for him.
Mm-hmm.
So
so what is the question?
So the question is, bias. I do pray for him, and he's in a nursing home. I don't wish him any bad, but by me not taking on that role of saying, oh, come live with me in my home, let me take care of you, is that wrong of me?
Oh, I understand. So the question is, do you have a duty, because of the commandment to honor your mother and your father, to take care of him in your home rather than in a nursing home?
Yes, doctor.
Okay. I would say not necessarily. I don't think that you, even though he was not a good father to you, I don't think that you can have callous indifference to him. But even if he had been a good father to you, you know, questions like, where is it best to take care of somebody? Is it best to take care of them in the home? Is it best to take care of them in a medical facility or in a nursing home? Even those are questions, the answer to which is not, it's not sort of one size fits all. It depends on a lot of different circumstances. Is the person suffering from a disease? Is he so demanding that it would be impossible to take care of him in a home setting? Would he just perish of loneliness if he were in a nursing facility? And so, even apart from the commandment to honor one's mother and father, I don't think that I could tell you in which of the two settings he should be taken care of. Now, there's a more general question behind your question, and that is: is my responsibility to honor my father attenuated by the fact that he wasn't a good father? And I think that I wouldn't say that you're not obligated to honor him, but I would say that, you know, the question arises: well, what does honor require of me? Let's say that a drunken father commands a child to do something dangerous. In a case like this, honoring him does not require obedience to everything that he says. Now, let's say that he's sober and he knows better than the child, and he's commanding things to so that the child learns for himself what is dangerous and what is not dangerous. Well, the child ought to be obeying him. So even the requirements of honor, what it means to honor, are not identical in every case. Okay, I sympathize with you. You have to love your father. Yet you have to love all people, and it's difficult to know whether you're acting with. It's going to be difficult for you to know. If I decide to keep him in a nursing home, am I doing this because it's the best thing for him, or am I doing it because I still have resentment for him? And you're going to need a lot of help from God's grace. You know, you're going to need help from people who support you in this very difficult love, and help from God to be honest with your own heart. I can't tell you precisely what you ought to do, but I think that, but I recognize the difficulty of your situation, and may God bless you here.
Thank you. Yes, my siblings keep using the term, you reap what you sow, and he's, you know, this is what's happening to him. And,
I think that's a little bit heartless. I'm influenced here by the fact that I abandoned God completely at one earlier point in my life. Now, I wasn't drunk, and I didn't abandon my wife and my kids, and I didn't, you know, there are a lot of things I didn't do. But on the other hand, I really needed mercy. And if there is a law of natural consequences, I've suffered from my sins. But if God hadn't had mercy on me, and if other people hadn't loved me despite my sins, I would be nowhere. So I think that we do reap as we sow, but it doesn't mean that we should just rejoice in the fact that somebody is reaping what he sowed. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, yes, definitely.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Monica. We have to go to a quick break, and we'll be right back with more on the natural law on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Have a question? We've got answers.
Catholic Answers
Live.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
We've all heard the words at the end of Mass.
Go forth and announce the gospel of the Lord.
But how exactly are you to do that? In his new book, The Old Evangelization, How to Spread the Faith Like Jesus Did, apologist Eric Sammons takes you back to the source, taking a look at what Jesus did when he preached the good news and drawing out the lessons he taught us. All evangelization begins with a personal encounter, and so Sammons examines Jesus' most instructive gospel encounters and discovers within each a particular truth that even 2,000 years later can help us make new disciples. Evangelization is not an option, but Christ's express command. What better way to answer this call than by imitating his supreme example? Order your copy of The Old Evangelization today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. In a series of short, easy-to-read chapters, Trent covers the whole range of common topics, starting with why we believe in anything at all and answering all the common objections to the Catholic faith, both doctrinal and moral. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Better yet, it's only $3 a copy when you order in bulk. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We are talking natural law with one of the world's experts in the natural law, Dr. Jay Bujaszewski, and the author, among many other books, of What We Can't Not Know, which is one of my favorite titles, because there are things in us, like the moral law, that you can't not know it. You can pretend not to know it, but you can't not know it. We go now to Anonymous in Colorado, listening on EWTN. Anonymous, your question for Dr. B.
Yeah, thank you. My question changed a little bit based on what I just heard listening to the previous callers, but and just sharing my own experience. At certain point, I was a little bit, my heart was a little bit hardened. So I now that see the things differently. I see the creation, the beauty of the creation, what God is doing for us, has done for us, and how he still suffered for us. I think that my change of heart was due to his grace. Now, here on earth, wanted to do something to really help others. I feel that it's so hard, not because we are not, don't have the power that God has of, giving grace to, we don't have that power. How can we have others who have that hardened heart to see God's beauty, and especially people that have walked away from the church, and also that are pro-choice. They have to have them to see the truth from our standpoint of view as humans. We don't have that power, but how can we make a good argument to help them see the truth in terms of natural law.
Okay.
Okay. I what I'm hearing is really two questions. One is there anything that we can do to cooperate with the grace of God as God is seeking people whose hearts are hardened? And the second one, which is connected with it, is how can we make a pro-life argument to somebody who's hardened in a pro-abortion position? So let me try to answer both. As to the first one, you know, the moral law itself, we sometimes think of that as though it had nothing to do with God's grace, that there's just this, the moral law has a heart of rock and it just makes these demands of us. But actually the moral law itself, the natural law itself, is a gift of grace. It points out to us how we need to live. We need more grace than just that. We need the grace to see that we don't live up to it. We need the grace to have the power to live up to it. But the moral law itself is a bit of grace. And so sometimes one of the things that we can do is just when a person is willing to talk about the moral law, to be willing to talk about them with it. We have to be careful because sometimes a conversation can degenerate into a situation where the other person is just trying to catch us and lay pitfalls for us and be clever. But if it's a genuine conversation seeking the truth, that can be very helpful. And just the example of your own conversation, your own patience, your own willingness to stay in a loving relationship with the person on the other side is itself an example of the grace of God and has a lot of influence on people. Now, specifically as to the question of abortion, you know, I commented on the things that you can't not know. One of the things that we can't not know is that murder is wrong. It is wrong to deliberately take innocent human life. Now, the funny thing about it is that even the person who is in favor of abortion knows that. Even the person who is in favor of abortion knows that it is wrong to deliberately take innocent human life. And this knowledge forces them to make excuses. They have to pretend to themselves that they don't know that abortion is the taking of an innocent human life. So if they're open to the conversation, one of the things that we can do is just point this out and lead them through and say, is the reason you think it's okay because you think that the baby isn't innocent? That seems, there actually are pro-abortion people who say that, believe it or not, but most people won't. Is the reason that you think this is okay because you don't believe that what's inside the womb is a human? You know, it's not a dog in there. It's not a porpoise. This is a developing human being with human DNA. Is it because you don't believe the act is deliberate? Is somebody else doing the abortion to you? Sometimes that's enough. Now, sometimes, on the other hand, because of the hardening of the heart, what we have a conscience, but it may be buried, and what we have is fingers in our ears, so to speak, so that we don't hear the voice of our conscience. Well, one thing that's important here is to remember that no heart is so hard that it is absolutely immune to grace, and so we have to pray for these people. I mean, day in and day out. And we have to stay in relationship with them. And here's why. There may be a day when you talk to somebody and that person's heart is hardened, and they may not even want to talk. But there may be another day when, for some reason or other, maybe they're down that day. Maybe there's something that has happened which is making them question their own life. Maybe they're feeling bad about their own previous abortion. And for some reason, some of the little plates in the armor fall away, and there's some way that we can reach through and touch the heart of that person, and they can hear what they weren't able to hear the other day. So we have to stay in a relationship so that we're always ready. And, you know, we're there on that day when they're ready to listen. But the argument, basically, in the simplest, you know, the simplest answer to you is the argument against abortion is simply that abortion is the deliberate taking of innocent human life. And we all know the deliberate taking of innocent human life is wrong.
Thank you very much, Anonymous, for that call. I hope that that was helpful to you. We go now
Before we go on, may I add one more little point?
Sure.
One mistake that we can sometimes make is this. You know, people sometimes make a mistake when they're talking to a non-believing neighbor by saying, the Bible says, and it says that we are holding a big copy of the Bible and beating them over the head. We also have to be careful not to say the natural law says, and beat them over the head with that. What we have to do is make arguments that are informed by the natural law, but we don't even have to necessarily use the phrase natural law if that produces a conditioned reflex. Okay?
Yes. Go ahead. Right. Very clear. Okay, Andrew, in Columbus, Ohio, listening on 820 AM St. Gabriel Radio, you are on with Dr. J. Oh, no, I should say Dr. B. I picked the wrong letter. Dr. B, what's your question?
Thank you both. I appreciate you taking the time to hear me. I know we're at the end of the program. Dr. B, you had mentioned about healing earlier and the right.
Did you say healing or feeling?
That was feeling.
Feeling, right? like emotion, feeling.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to kind of give you the direction I'm coming from on this, but the real question is resources that I could turn to that deal with, I guess, the rightness, wrongness of feelings.
Oh yes, well the feelings. Let's say that you have a feeling of malice. You know, you want to, the classical literature on the virtues is probably the main place to look for this. Okay? You look up the classical Christian writers on the virtues, and they talk a lot about this. Sometimes, it's very popular today to say, and this is wrong, that people do say this today, they say feelings are neither right nor wrong, they just are. Well, that's not true. If I have a feeling of hatred, for instance, that's wrong. If I have a feeling of sexual desire for somebody who's not my wife, that's, you know, and you know, the neighbor lady next door or something, that's just wrong, and I need to discourage that feeling in myself. There are also feelings that are right. I should have feelings of compassion, although I need to learn when it's appropriate to have those feelings and in what way. It's not compassionate, for instance, to give a tenth piece of candy to a little child who's stuffing himself just because he wants it. Another mistake that people make about feelings is that they think that we can't control feelings. One of my students said that the other day. He says, well, I can see that maybe you could try to follow the moral law, but you can't do anything about your feelings. Sure, you can do something about your feelings. I mentioned the case of having sexual desire for the neighbor lady. Well, if you think about her day in and day out, you're going to be desiring her. If you try to think about other things, you're probably not going to be. If you have a tendency to overeat and you just read the food magazines all the time, you're going to be wanting to eat all the time. But if you just find other things to think about and other things to do, it becomes easier.
Thank you, Andrew, for that, and thank you, Doctor, so much for a really fascinating hour on natural law, and thank you for everyone who had questions. Our guest this hour has been Dr. J. Budziszewski. All kinds of great books from him. You can look on the Meaning of Sex, commentary on Thomas Aquinas' Treatise on the Law, commentary on Thomas Aquinas' Virtue Ethics, What We Can't Not Know, and you can find him at undergroundthomist.org. Dr. Budziszewski, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks to the questioners, too.
Yes, indeed. And next hour, the old evangelization. We hear a lot about the new evangelization. Are we still doing the old evangelization? Are we still doing that? Is that a thing? It is indeed a thing. Eric Sammons will be here to talk about it. We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live.